I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Blind Luck is a new novel by the author Scott Carter. He joins me now to discuss the book, which has been described as a rambunctious ride along that slippery slope called chance, as well as a poignant rumination on family, fortune, and fate. It's a book about gambling and family, death, and fate. Dave Bolden is a 30-something whose life is without direction. He's also incredibly lucky. We'll ask the author, who joins me now, to tell us more. Scott Carter is an author and screenwriter. He has worked on numerous feature and short films, and his own company, Sad But True Entertainment, has produced shorts for Bravo, as well as a reality series. He has been teaching high school English for 9 years, and he joins me from Toronto this day. The website for more is blindluck.ca. The book is published by Napoleon & Company. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Scott Carter. Good morning, Mr. Carter.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So tell me about Blind Luck.
Well, Blind Luck is the story of, on one level, it's a dysfunctional relationship between a father and a son. It's about a man who doesn't take any risks because he was raised by a man who was a gambling addict. And as a result, he doesn't take risks. He has a very sort of average life, and he finds himself at work one day, and a tragedy happens. And, you know, his life sort of spirals out of control from there, and his life has changed forever.
Now, Dave is incredibly lucky, right?
Absolutely.
What sort of lucky is he?
Well, what's interesting about it is he denies he's lucky because he believes he's just an average man. But what makes it fascinating is the more situations he finds himself in that test his luck, the more it appears like he actually could be lucky. And when he starts to reflect on his past and growing up and his father, he starts to see that a series of significant incidences from his childhood actually have context, and he could be lucky, is the idea.
Are you anything like Dave?
No. That's a great question. No, not at all. Dave is very, I take things much more seriously than he does. I think he sort of gets by day and does his best not to think about things, of course, until this happens. And I came from a much more stable family. His family is incredibly dysfunctional.
Do you gamble at all yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not to those extremes. I've dabbled in cards a little bit. I have a friend who's a professional poker player, so he showed me some things. And I've always been a huge football fan, so I mess around with football that way. But I'm always curious about if you can beat the system.
Do you play the lotto at all?
No, I've never been a lottery person.
Yeah,
there's not enough. I'm more fascinated in things where you can have a say in the outcome and try to make predictions more than just completely leave it up to chance.
And the sort of betting that goes on in the book, my understanding of it is that it's extreme betting, right?
Absolutely.
And that's prop betting. What is that?
Well, it's there's a range. There's an introduction to prop betting, and prop betting is basically where you have a proposition. So instead of betting on something that's pre-organized, it's a random proposition. Could be something as simple as you're in a restaurant and you bet someone if they could eat 10 hamburgers. Could be something even more random, like the next person to walk by on the street, I'll bet you $1,000 that you can't beat them in a foot race.
Yeah.
And some examples that pop up, I mean, it's actually quite huge in gambling culture. A lot of professional poker players, for example, have been known to, after a big victory, because, you know, it's as much for them the adrenaline as it is the actual card victory themselves. So there was a very famous prop bet recently, about a year ago, where two poker pros got together and one bet the other that they couldn't spend a month in a hotel bathroom. And so the other person, before they accepted the bet, actually customized the bathroom with like a flat screen TV and cable and made sure that they could have room service. So there were some ground rules to it, and
yeah.
Then what they did is you could follow it on a webcam to see if this guy would actually be able to spend 30 days in a hotel bathroom.
Are you lucky in your own life?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, not lucky the way... I mean, here's how I look at it. I've been asked this question a lot, sort of in promoting the book,
yeah.
And getting ready to have the book come out. And the more I get asked, the more I realize how complex a question it is. Because my sort of gut instinct is to say, I don't believe in luck, I believe in hard work. But when you piece together different aspects of your life, you can see that there's a lot of reason to believe. For people who want to believe, there's a lot of fodder that life offers up. So, you know, could be as simple as I have a daughter who's a year old. I feel incredibly lucky just to be able to have. I realize the combination of circumstances that had to come into play to make that happen.
Yeah.
But there's been sort of more extreme things as well in my life. A story I like to tell is my father, the day my father died, the next day I woke up in the morning, and the left side of my chin was numb. And I didn't think a lot of it because when someone, you know, especially when a parent dies, you're scrambling. You're a bit shocked yourself. There's a lot to do. You got to prepare for the funeral. But, I mean, it was numb. Like, when I was shaving, it felt like dead skin.
Yeah.
So a few days after the funeral and everything were settled, I went to the doctor, and they had me do a series. They said, you know, your blood work's fine, but you should know that facial numbness can be a symptom of a jaw tumor. So I was like, you know, immediately you're shocked, you're terrified. And I went and had a series of tests done, and luckily I came out okay. But when I showed up at the hospital to get the x-ray, they said to me, you know, do you have a hospital card? And I said, I've only been once before. It was about 10 years ago. And they said, they looked in the computer and said, actually, 10 years ago to the day.
Wow.
Which, you know, isn't that crazy? But again, when you start to add those things up, it gets a bit bizarre.
But isn't that coincidence, too?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things, the more I get asked the question, the more the debate begins when you talk to people. Where does sort of coincidence start or end, and where does luck start or end? And a lot of it has to do, I'm learning by seeing people's responses to the book already. It has a lot to do with your sort of personal philosophy on the world and your personal beliefs and faith.
So they're not the same then, right?
I don't think so.
No.
I think, you know, you can have a series of coincidences that aren't lucky or particularly unlucky that just are amusing.
Yeah.
You know, the one I just gave you, for example, there's nothing particularly negative or positive in my life about that, but on paper, it's a bit odd.
Yeah. Now, this is the first novel, right?
Yeah, first novel.
Yeah. How different is that from screenwriting? I heard someone once say that you use the whole page, I guess, when you're novel writing as opposed to when you're screenwriting.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's incredibly different, and I'll get into that in a second, but in some ways it's not different. You know, writing tends to be writing in terms of the process and the creative process and the joy that you get from putting words on a paper or then transferring them to the screen. I mean, in my case, I actually still do write pen and paper first draft around. And a lot of the times I'll start scenes with dialogue because I've done a lot of short films in the past and then moved into screenwriting. So for me, there are differences for sure. One of the big differences would be the amount of detail you can go into. So from a creative standpoint, you know, creating a narrative, you're in total control of every decision. Whereas in film, you know, you're very much relying on the director. The director is as important, if not more important, than the screenwriter in terms of, you know, the final product.
And so you said you write the first draft with pen and paper.
Yeah.
Is that because you think better that way, or...?
Well, there's a few reasons. One, it lends itself to be able to do it anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, only in the last couple of years do I have a laptop. So for years, it was sort of pen and paper allows you to do it wherever you are. And then the biggest reason for me is that there's that direct transfer. It's a real big editing revision process for me to take it from pad and paper and put it to the actual computer screen. It's the most important revision I go through.
Yeah, what's your penmanship like?
You know, half decent, average,
yeah.
Nothing special. But probably because I do so much of it, a little better than the average person.
Yeah. Did you always write? Like, did you grow
what
up?
I mean, always. How far back are you going?
Yeah. Did you grow up wanting to be a writer?
No, I didn't. However, I was one of those people where that was always sort of my best, most natural subject in school. It was the thing that came easiest to me. It was the thing I enjoyed most. And I knew in university my first passion was becoming a book editor. I knew I wanted to be around editing. And then as in university, I started to write more and more, both for campus papers as a journalist, contributed some short stories, and eventually got into sort of short film, and then from there became committed more as a profession.
One of the characters in the book is Mr. Thorin. Who's he?
He is the man. What happens is when this tragedy happens at Dave's work, there's a man who's scheduled to have an appointment with him that day, and he interprets Dave's survival as luck. He's an eccentric businessman who works in the high-stakes world of financing, and he's always, much like the gamblers I described, poker players, he's looking for that next thrill. So it's no longer about money for him, it's about thrill. And he interprets Dave's survival as luck and sets out to exploit that luck.
There's in the material that your publicist sent, there's a question here, and this isn't my question. Who was the inspiration for Mr. Thorin?
Well, no inspiration. It was sort of the idea that one of the things I loved playing with, one of the themes of this book that may not jump out at people at first because it's so obviously about luck and tests of luck, and also there's the story about lineage and family, is the idea that every skill in life life, it fascinates me that in society, whenever someone's recognized for something, it's never simply appreciated. It's always looked to be exploited. We don't look at amazing athletes and say, wow, let's enjoy watching this woman or man run. We want to see, want to exploit them. Let's get them on TV. Let's have them do it in front of as many people as possible. Let's turn it into a business. Even all these reality shows, it's not about the joy of watching someone or listening to someone sing or looking at a beautiful person on a modeling show. It's about competition and exploitation of that skill and or talent. So I find it fascinating that if there was someone who was incredibly lucky, it wouldn't be just appreciated or marveled. There would be someone out there looking at it as a resource.
And do you think that, that we can be lucky? Or, like you talked about your own life, that a lot of the success you've had is because of hard work. Can we train ourselves to be lucky, do you think?
Yeah, in researching this book, I came across some incredible philosophies because, you know, I wanted to, not so much for the accuracy of it, because I don't know if there is a lot of accuracy in exploring luck, because a lot of it is sort of belief, but I wanted to see what the opinions were out there. And there are people who have their PhDs who study luck and probability and chance for a living. And the consensus in that world tends to be that people who are lucky tend to be risk takers. People, sorry, who are perceived as lucky tend to be risk takers. So they're more likely to put themselves into positions and put themselves out there in the world where the things that happen to people that people associate with luck will happen. Whereas unlucky people tend to be people who are more reserved, less likely to take a risk, and less likely to be resilient. That was the word that popped up, that kept popping up in my research, is that there's a real correlation between unlucky people and an inability to keep persevering. So if one bad thing happens, that's it, it's over for them.
So are gamblers lucky then?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, despite the fact that I'm talking about it very academically, if you take a lot of people from, you know, many different walks of life, whether it be athletics or stockbrokers or card players, for example, a friend of mine, I told you, is a professional poker player, they'd argue intensely with passion that luck is very much a real thing. They talk all the time about going on bad beats and they're not getting the right cards and luck's not with them, and you got to know when to ride your luck, and when you're running hot, you got to run with that luck, and when you're running cold, you stay away from the tables. So, you know, I've learned that I don't have the answers. I'm just like everyone else in that I have an opinion. But what I'm excited about is what I sort of kind of instinctually understood as being a topic of interest for people is proving to be true. I mean, people consider and think about luck all the time, and they think about how it pertains to their own life a lot. So that's a lot of fun.
Do you like reading? I mean,
I love reading.
Yeah. And as a writer, that's obviously important to you, right?
Hugely important.
Yeah. Well, you also teach high school English, right?
I do.
Yeah. Now, as someone who writes, someone who likes to read, does it frustrate you being a teacher when a lot of your students don't necessarily all want to be there?
Well, I'll tell you what. First, I love teaching as well. Teaching is a wonderful profession, and it's been amazing to me. So for me, I love being a teacher. I started out actually working in publishing, so I could easily still be doing that.
Yeah.
It was kind of a good thing to not be a teacher first, because I don't have those doubts about what is outside the world of teaching. I spent a few years as an apprenticing editor and then a full-time editor, so I know what's out there. And you'd be amazed at, well, the perception is a lot of people don't like school, and there's no doubt that you start off a course selling something no one's buying. But people love to read when you give them the right material, whether they're amazing students who are on their way to, you know, prestigious schools, or whether they're people who have yet to find reading in their life. If you give them the right material, I've yet to see someone not flame on and become passionate about it. I think as people, we love to be told stories, and we underestimate in society that reading's a skill, and it takes time, and people who have, you know, who it doesn't come easy to, they have to build that skill up and be given the right material before they love it. But once they do, the good news is people love reading.
Now you were born in Toronto?
I was born and raised.
Yeah. It's a character in the book, I understand.
Yes.
Yeah. I've never been there. And so the view that one has of it is that it is cold and that it, you know, it's a big metropolis, if you will.
Yeah.
Is sort of the view that we have of Toronto, if you read your book?
Yeah, well, 100% true in that. First, I'll tell you sort of my perception of Toronto, in that it is definitely a big city. And definitely a place, I mean, it's one of the most multicultural places on the planet, which is what I love about it most. If you walk down the street, jump on a subway, came into my classroom or any other classroom in the city, or most of them anyway, you would certainly see a representation of many, many cultures and people, which is, you know, a wonderful thing. The book tries to capture that a bit. There's a series of segments where Dave is going around the city in cabs, and you get a taste for sort of how multicultural the city is, and you get a taste for how, in a city, anything can happen. You get a feeling in a big city that anything can happen at any time, and I think the book sort of aspires to capture that feeling.
And I understand there's interest into making this into a movie, the book?
Yeah, I mean, it's very early at this point, but sort of because of my history in the world of film, it's sort of a natural fit. This was a project that could have easily become a screenplay first, but it had always been an aspiration of mine to write a book. And in many ways, when I first started out, when I finished university, I started to publish short stories and work in the world of publishing, that was actually my first pursuit. And I kind of fell into screenwriting because I did some short films and they ended up doing well in festivals, and then I was approached to do more work on feature-length scripts, whether it be rewrites or development and whatever, and then eventually work on some of my own projects. That just, you know, years go by. The world of film is wonderful in that it's a collaborative process, it's intense, and you learn a lot on a daily basis. But time goes by as well, because, you know, the average duration of projects in film can be 3, 4, 5 years, and that's considered standard. So when the opportunity came up to do this project as a book, I jumped at it, because I love books, I love reading, and to contribute a verse is a wonderful opportunity.
Would you write another novel?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's my next priority.
Yeah.
So I recently finished a new script, but I'm also at work on a new book. So the infant stages, but it'll definitely happen.
Yeah, and so how long does a book like Blind Luck take?
Oh, wow. Ask any different writer and they'll tell you a different story that way. This particular book took in the range of 8 months for a first draft, and then sort of the whole publishing process during revision. So that could have been anywhere off and on in intensity to another 6 months.
Yeah, and the revision part, that's just as laborious as the writing, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the people at Napoleon are wonderful. The publisher there, Sylvia McConnell, was a great mentor. My editor, Alistair, this is the most enjoyable creative experience I've had, and I owe that to him, his passion, his precision, and he really pushed the material to its potential. And so for me, I'm hooked.
It's been a pleasure talking to you today, Scott. It just sounds like a fascinating book and one that we might even pick up.
That'd be super. I appreciate your interest and your time.
Will do, yeah. The book is called Blind Luck. It's published by Napoleon & Company. The website for more is blindluck.ca. Its author, Scott Carter, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.